Chapter 4. I wasn't exactly alone. 10 feet to my right, a woman sat on a wooden chair just like mine, staring through the holes of the steel lattice at a man on the other side. By bending an ear, I could have caught what the man was saying. But I didn't try because I assumed she was as much in favor of privacy as I was. 10 feet to my left, a man on another chair like mine was also staring through the lattice at a lad who wasn't as old as Paul Harold had been when the picture was taken. I couldn't help hearing what he was saying, and apparently he didn't give a damn. The boy across the lattice from him was looking bored. There were 3 or 4 cops around, and the one who had brought me in was standing back near the wall, also looking bored. During the formalities of getting passed in, which had been handled by Fryer, I had been told that I would be allowed 15 minutes, and I was about to leave my chair to tell the cop that I hoped he wouldn't start timing me until the prisoner arrived, when a door opened in the wall on the other side of the lattice, and there he was, with a guard behind his elbow. The guard steered him across to a chair opposite me and then backed up to the wall some 5 paces. The convict sat on the edge of the chair and blinked through the holes at me. "I don't know you," he said. "Who are you?" At that moment, with his pale, hollow cheeks and his dead eyes and his lips so thin he almost didn't have any, he looked a lot more than 11 years away from the kid in the flat top. I hadn't decided how to open up because I do better if I wait until I have a man's face to choose words. I had a captive audience, of course, but that wouldn't help me if he clammed up on me. I tried to get his eyes, but the damn lattice was in the way. "My name is Goodwin," I told him, "Archie Goodwin. Have you ever heard of a private detective named Nero Wolfe?" "Yes, I've heard of him. What do you want?" His voice was hollower than his cheeks and deader than his eyes. "I work for Mr. Wolfe. Day before yesterday, your father, James R. Harold, came to his office and hired him to find you. He said he had learned that you didn't steal that money 11 years ago, and he wanted to make it square with you. The way things stand, that may not mean much to you, but there it is." Considering the circumstances, he did pretty well. His jaw sagged for a second, but he jerked it up, and his voice was just the same when he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. My name is Peter Hayes." I nodded at him. "I knew you'd say that, of course. I'm sorry, Mr. Harold, but it won't work. The trouble is that Mr. Wolfe needs money, and he uses part of it to pay my salary. So we're going to inform your father that we have found you, and of course he'll be coming to see you. The reason I'm here, we thought it only fair to let you know about it before he comes." "I haven't got any father." His jaw was stiff now, and it affected his voice. "You're wrong. You've made a mistake. If he comes, I won't see him." I shook my head. "Let's keep our voices down. What about the scar on your left leg on the inside of the knee?" "It's no go, Mr. Harold. Perhaps you can refuse to see your father. I don't know how much say they give a man in your situation. But he'll certainly come when we notify him. By the way, if we had had any doubt at all of your identity, you have just settled it. The way you said, if he comes, you won't see him." "Why should you get excited about it if he's not your father?" "If we've made a mistake, the easiest way to prove it is to let him come and take a look at you. We didn't engage to persuade you to see him. Our job was just to find you, and we've done that. And if..." I stopped because he started to shake. I could have got up and left, since my mission was accomplished, but Fryer wouldn't like it if I put his client in a state of collapse and just walked out on him. And after all, Fryer had got me in. So I stuck. There was a counter on both sides to keep us away from the lattice, and he had his fists on his, rubbing it with little jerks. "Hang on," I told him. "I'm going. We thought you ought to know." "Wait." He stopped shaking. "Will you wait?" "Sure." He took his fists off the counter and his head thrust forward. "I can't see you very well. Listen to me, for God's sake. For God's sake, don't tell him. You don't know what he's like.
Well, I've met him.
And my mother and sisters, they'll know. I think they believed I was framed on stealing that money. I think they believed me, but he didn't. And now I've been framed again. For God's sake, don't tell him. This time it's all over. I'm going to die, and I might as well be dead now. And it's not fair for me to have this, too. I don't want them to know. My God, don't you see how it is?
Yeah, I see how it is. I was wishing I had gone.
Then promise me you won't tell him. You look like a decent guy. If I've got to die for something I didn't do, all right, I can't do anything about that. But not this, too. I know I'm not saying this right. I know I'm not myself, but if you only...
I didn't know why he stopped, because, listening to him, I didn't hear the cop approaching from behind. There was a tap on my shoulder and the cop's voice. Time's up. I arose.
Promise me, Paul Harold demanded.
I can't, I told him, and turned and walked out. Fryer was waiting for me in the visitor's room. I don't carry a mirror, so I don't know how my face looked when I joined him, but when we had left the building and were on the sidewalk, he asked,
"It didn't work?"
"You can't always tell by my expression," I said. "Ask the people I play poker with. But if you don't mind, I'll save it for Mr. Wolf, since he pays my salary. Coming along?" Evidently he was. I'll hand it to him that he could take a hint. In the taxi, when I turned my head to the window to study the scenery as we rolled along, he made no attempt to start a conversation. But he overdid it a little. When we stopped at the curb in front of the old brownstone, he spoke. "If you want a word with Wolf first, I'll wait out here." I laughed. "No, come on in and I'll find you some earmuffs." I preceded him up the stoop and pushed the button, and Fritz let us in. And we put our hats and coats on the rack and went down the hall to the office. Wolf, at his desk pouring beer, shot me a glance, greeted Fryer, and asked if he would like some beer. The lawyer declined and took the red leather chair without waiting for an invitation. I stood and told Wolf, "I saw him and talked with him. Instead of a yes or no, I'd like to give you a verbatim report. Do you want Mr. Fryer to hear it?" Wolf lifted his glass from the tray.
"Is there any reason why he shouldn't?"
"No, sir."
"Then go ahead."
I didn't ham it, but I gave them all the words, which was no strain, since the only difference between me and a tape recorder is that a tape recorder can't lie. I lie to Wolf only on matters that are none of his business, and this was his business. As I say, I didn't ham it, but I thought they ought to have a clear picture. So I described Paul Harold's condition. His stiff jaw, his shaking, his trying to shove his fists through the counter, and the look in his eyes when he said it wasn't fair for him to have this too. I admit one thing. I made the report standing up so I could put my fists on Wolf's desk to show how Paul Harold had looked on the counter. When I was through, I slid the chair out from my desk and sat. "If you still want a firm conclusion," I said, "it is yes." Wolf put his glass down, took in air clear to his belly button, and shut his eyes. Fryer was shaking his head with his jaw set. "I've never had a case like it," he said, apparently to himself, "and I never want another one." He looked at Wolf. "What are you going to do? You can't just shut your eyes on it."
"They're my eyes," Wolf muttered, keeping them closed.
In a moment he opened them.
"Archie, that's why you wanted Mr. Fryer to hear your report, to make it even more difficult."
I lifted my shoulders and dropped them.
"No argument."
"Then send Mr. Harold a telegram saying merely that we have found his son, alive and well, here in New York. That was our job. Presumably he will come."
Fryer made a noise and came forward in his chair. I looked at Wolf, swallowed, and spoke.
"You do it. I've got a sore finger. Just dial Western Union, 0027111. He laughed. A stranger would have called it a snort, but I know his different snorts. He laughed some more.
It's fairly funny, I said, but have you heard the one about the centipede in the shoe store?
Fryer said positively, I think we should discuss it. Wolf nodded. I agree. I was merely forcing Mr. Goodwin to reveal his position. He looked at me. You prefer to wire Mr. Harold that I have decided I don't like the job?
If those are the only alternatives, yes. As he said, he might as well be dead. He's practically a corpse, and I don't have to rob corpses to eat, and neither do you.
Your presentment is faulty, Wolf objected. No robbery is contemplated. However, I am quite willing to consider other alternatives. The decision, of course, is mine. Mr. Harold gave me the job of finding his son, and it is wholly in my discretion whether to inform him that the job is done. He stopped to drink some beer. Fryer said, As the son's attorney, I have some voice in the matter. Wolf put the glass down and passed his tongue over his lips. No, sir. Not on this specific question. However, though you have no voice, you certainly have an interest, and it deserves to be weighed. We'll look at it first. Those two alternatives, telling my client that his son is found, or telling him that I withdraw from my job, call them A and B. If A, my surmise is that you would be through. He would come to see his son and survey the situation and decide whether to finance an appeal. If he decided no, that would end it. If he decided yes, he would probably also decide that you had mishandled the case and he would hire another lawyer. I base that on the impression I got of him. Archie? Right. I was emphatic. Wolf returned to Fryer. And if B, you'd be left where you are now. How much would an appeal cost?
That depends. A lot of investigation would be required. As a minimum, $20,000. To fight it through to the end, using every expedient, a lot more.
Your client can't furnish it?
No.
Can you?
No.
Then B is no better for you than A. Now, what about me? A should be quite simple and satisfactory. I've done a job and I collect my fee. But not only must I pay my bills, I must also sustain my self-esteem. That man, your client, has been wounded in his very bowels, and to add insult to his injury as a mere mercenary would be a wanton act. I can't afford it. Even if I must gainsay Rochefoucauld, who wrote that we should only affect compassion and carefully avoid having any.
He picked up his glass, emptied it, and put it down.
Won't you have some beer, or something else?
No, thank you. I never drink before cocktail time.
Coffee? Milk? Water?
No, thanks.
Very well. As for B, I can't afford that either. I've done what I was hired to do, and I intend to be paid. And I have another reason for rejecting B. It would preclude my taking any further interest in this affair, and I don't like that. You said yesterday that you are convinced that your client is innocent. I can't say that I am likewise convinced, but I strongly suspect that you're right. With reason. He paused because we were both staring, and he loves to make people stare.
With reason, Fryer demanded. What reason?
Satisfied with the stares, he resumed. When Mr. Goodwin left here yesterday afternoon to go to look at your client, a man followed him.
Why?
It's barely possible that it was someone bearing a grudge on account of some former activity of ours, but highly unlikely. It would be puerile for such a person merely to follow Mr. Goodwin when he left the house.
He must be somehow connected with the present activity, and we are engaged in none at the moment except Mr. Harold's job.
Was Mr. Harold checking on us?
Absurd.
The obvious probability is that my advertisement was responsible. Many people, newspapers, the police, you yourself, had assumed that it was directed at Peter Hayes, and others might well have done so. One, let us say, named X. X wants to know why I declare Peter Hayes to be innocent, but does not come or phone to ask me. And he wants to know what I am doing about it. What other devices he may have resorted to, I don't know, but one of them was to come or send someone to stand post near my house. Wolf turned a hand over. How account for so intense and furtive a curiosity? If the murder for which Peter Hayes was on trial was what it appeared to be, a simple and commonplace act of passion, who could be so inquisitive and also so stealthy? Then it wasn't so simple. You said yesterday that you were convinced that your client was the victim of a diabolical frame-up. If you're correct, no wonder a man was sent to watch my house when I announced on the last day of his trial that he was known to be innocent, as was assumed. And it is with reason that I suspect that there is someone, somewhere, who felt himself threatened by my announcement. That doesn't convince me that your client is innocent, but it poses a question that needs an answer. Fryer turned to me. Who followed you? I told him I didn't know and told him why, and described the tale. He said the description suggested no one to him and went back to Wolf. Then you reject A and B for both of us. Is there a C?
I think there is, Wolf declared. You want to appeal. Can you take preliminary steps for an appeal without committing yourself to any substantial outlay for 30 days?
Yes, easily.
Very well. You want to appeal, and I want to collect my fee. I warned my client that the search might take months. I shall tell him merely that I am working on his problem, as I shall be. You will give me all the information you have, all of it, and I'll investigate. In 30 days, much less, I hope, I'll know where we stand. If it is hopeless, there will be nothing for it but A or B, and that decision can wait. If it is promising, we'll proceed. If and when we get evidence that will clear your client, my client will be informed and he will foot the bill. Your client may not like it, but he'll have to lump it. And anyway, I doubt if he would really rather die in the electric chair than face his father again, especially since he will be under no burden of guilt, either of theft or of murder. I make the proposal not as a paragon, but only as a procedure less repugnant than either A or B.
Well, sir?
The lawyer was squinting at him.
You say you'll investigate. Who will pay for that?
I will. That's the rub. I'll hope to get it back.
But if you don't?
Then I don't.
There should be a written agreement.
There won't be. I take the risk of failure. You'll have to take the risk of my depravity.
Wolf's voice suddenly became a bellow.
Confound it, it is your client who has been convicted of murder, not mine.
Fryer was startled, as well he might be. Wolf can bellow.
I meant no offense, he said mildly. I had no thought of depravity. As you say, the risk is yours. I accept your proposal. Now what?
Wolf glanced up at the wall clock and settled back in his chair. A full hour till lunchtime.
Now, he said, I want all the facts. I've read the newspaper accounts, but I want them from you.
Chapter 5. Peter Hayes had been convicted of killing the husband of the woman he loved on the evening of January 3rd by shooting him in the side of the head, above the left ear, with a Marley 38. I might as well account for things as I go along, but I can't account for the Marley because it had been taken by a burglar from a house in Poughkeepsie in 1947
and hadn't been seen in public since. The prosecution hadn't explained how Peter Hayes had got hold of it, so you can't expect me to. The victim, Michael M. Malloy, 43, a real estate broker, had lived with his wife, no children, in a four-room apartment on the top floor, the fifth, of a remodeled tenement on East 52nd Street. There was no other apartment on the floor. At 9:18 p.m. on January 3rd, a man had phoned police headquarters and said he had just heard a shot fired on one of the upper floors of the house next door. He gave the address of the house next door, 171 East 52nd Street, but hung up without giving his name. And he had never been located, though of course the adjoining houses had been canvassed. At 9:23, a cop from a prowl car had entered the building. When he got to the top floor, after trying two floors below and drawing blanks, he found the door standing open and entered. Two men were inside, one alive and one dead. The dead one, Malloy, was on the living room floor. The live one, Peter Hayes, with his hat and topcoat on, had apparently been about to leave, and when the cop had stopped him, he had tried to tear away and had to be subdued. When he was under control, the cop had frisked him and found the Marley 38 in his topcoat pocket. All that had been in the papers. Also, Peter Hayes was a copywriter. He had been with the same advertising agency, one of the big ones, for 8 years, and that was as far back as he went. His record and reputation were clean, with no high or low spots. Unmarried, he had lived for the past 3 years in an RBK, room, bath, and kitchenette, on West 63rd Street. He played tennis, went to shows and movies, got along all right with people, had a canary in his room, owned 5 suits of clothes, 4 pairs of shoes, and 3 hats, and had no car. A key to the street door of 171 East 52nd Street had been found on his key ring. The remodeled building had a do-it-yourself elevator, and there was no doorman. The district attorney's office, the personnel of Homicide West, all the newspapers, and millions of citizens were good and sore at Peter Hayes because he wasn't playing the game. The DA and cops couldn't check his version of what had happened, and the papers couldn't have it analyzed by experts, and the citizens couldn't get into arguments about it, because he supplied no version. From the time he had been arrested until the verdict came, he had refused to supply anything at all. He had finally, urged by his lawyer, answered one question put by the DA in a private interview. Had he shot Malloy? No. But why and when had he gone to the apartment? What were his relations with Malloy and with his wife? Why was a key to that building on his key ring? Why did he have the Marley 38 in his pocket? No reply. Nor to 1,000 other questions. Other people had been more chatty, some of them on the witness stand. The Malloy's daily maid had seen Mrs. Malloy and the defendant in close embrace on 3 different occasions during the past 6 months. But she had not told Mr. Malloy because she liked Mrs. Malloy, and it was none of her business. Even so, Mr. Malloy must have been told something by somebody, or seen or heard something, because the maid had heard him telling her off and had seen him twisting her arm until she collapsed. A private detective, hired by Malloy late in November, had seen Mrs. Malloy and Peter Hayes meet at a restaurant for lunch 4 times, but nothing juicier. There were others, but those were the outstanding items. The prosecution's main attraction, though not its mainstay, had been the widow, Selma Malloy. She was 29, 14 years younger than her husband, and was photogenic, judging from the pictures the papers had run. Her turn on the witness stand had sparked a debate. The assistant DA had claimed the right to ask her certain questions because she was a hostile witness, and the judge had refused to allow the claim. For example, the ADA had tried to ask her, "Was Peter Hayes your lover?" But he had to settle for, "What were the relations between you and Peter Hayes?" She said she liked Peter Hayes very much. She said she regarded him as a good friend, and she had affection for him. and believed he had affection for her. The relations between them could not properly be called misconduct. As for the relations between her and her husband, she had begun to feel less than a year after their marriage, which had taken place 3 years ago, that the marriage had been a mistake. She should have known it would be, since for a year before their marriage she had worked for Malloy as his secretary. And she should have known what kind of man he was. The prosecutor had fired at her. "Do you think he was the kind of man who should be murdered?" And Fryer had objected and been sustained, and the prosecutor had asked, "What kind of man was he?" Fryer had objected to that, too, as calling for an opinion on the part of the witness, and that had started another debate. It was brought out, specifically, that he had falsely accused her of infidelity, had physically mistreated her, had abused her in the presence of others, and had refused to let her get a divorce. She had seen Peter Hayes at a New Year's Eve party 3 days before the murder, and had not seen him since until she entered the courtroom that day. She had spoken with him on the telephone on January 1st and again on January 2nd, but she couldn't remember the details of the conversations, only that nothing noteworthy had been said. The evening of January 3rd, a woman friend had phoned around 7:30 to say that she had an extra ticket for a show and invited her to come, and she had accepted. When she got home around midnight, there were policemen in her apartment, and she was told the news. Fryer had not cross-examined her. One of the 100 or so details of privileged communications between a lawyer and a client furnished us by Fryer explained that. He had promised Peter Hayes he wouldn't. Wolfe snorted, not his laughing snort. "Isn't it," he inquired, "a function of counsel to determine the strategy and tactics of defense?" "When he can, yes." Fryer, who had spent 3/4 of an hour reviewing the testimony and answering questions about it, had lubricated himself with a glass of water. "Not with this client. I've said he is difficult. Mrs. Malloy was the prosecution's last witness. I had 5, and none of them helped any." "Do you want to discuss them?"
"No."
Wolfe looked at the wall clock. 20 minutes to lunch. "I've read the newspaper accounts. I would like to know why you're convinced of his innocence."
"Well, it's a combination of things. His expressions, his tones of voice, his reactions to my questions and suggestions, some questions he has asked me, many things. But there was one specific thing. During my first talk with him, the day after he was arrested, I got the idea that he had refused to answer any of their questions because he wanted to protect Mrs. Malloy, either from being accused of the murder, or of complicity, or merely from harassment. At our second talk, I got a little further with him. I told him that exchanges between a lawyer and his client were privileged and their disclosure could not be compelled, and that if he continued to withhold vital information from me, I would have to retire from the case. He asked what would happen if I did retire, and he engaged no other counsel, and I said the court would appoint counsel to defend him, that on a capital charge he would have to be represented by counsel. He asked if anything he told me would have to come out at the trial, and I said not without his consent. The water glass had been refilled, and he took a sip. Then he told me some things, and more later. He said that on the evening of January 3rd he had been in his apartment alone, and had just turned on the radio for the 9 o'clock news when the phone rang. He answered it, and a man's voice said, "Pete Hayes, this is a friend. I just left the Malloys, and Mike was starting to beat her up. Do you hear me?" He said yes, and started to ask a question, but the man hung up. He grabbed his hat and coat and ran, took a taxi across the park, used his key on the street door, took the elevator to the 5th floor, found the door of the Malloy apartment ajar, and went in. Malloy was lying there. He looked through the apartment and found no one. He went back to Malloy and decided he was dead. A gun was on a chair against the wall, 15 feet from the body. He picked it up and put it in his pocket, and was looking around to see if there was anything else when he heard footsteps in the hall. He thought he would hide, then thought he wouldn't. And as he started for the door, the policeman entered. That was his story. This is the first time anyone has heard it but me. I could have traced the cab, but why spend money on it? It could have happened, just as he said, with only one difference, that Malloy was alive when he entered. Wolf grunted.
Then I don't suppose that convinced you of his innocence?
Certainly not. I'll come to that. To clean up as I go along. When I had him talking, I asked why he had the key, and he said that on taking Mrs. Malloy home from the New Year's Eve party, he had taken her key to open the door for her and had carelessly neglected to return it to her. Probably not true.
Not material. The problem is murder, not the devices of gallantry. What else?
I told him that it was obvious that he was deeply attached to Mrs. Malloy and was trying to protect her. His rushing to her on getting the anonymous phone call, his putting the gun in his pocket, his refusal to talk to the police, not only made that conclusive, but also strongly indicated that he believed or suspected that she had killed her husband. He didn't admit it, but he didn't deny it, and for myself I was sure of it, provided he hadn't killed him himself. I told him that his refusal to divulge matters even to his attorney was understandable as long as he held that suspicion, but that now that Mrs. Malloy was definitely out of it, I expected of him full and candid cooperation. She was completely in the clear, I said, because the woman and two men with whom she had attended the theater had stated that she had been with them constantly throughout the evening. I had a newspaper with me containing that news and had him read it. He started to tremble, and the newspaper shook in his hands, and he called on God to bless me. I told him he needed God's blessing more than I did. Fryer cleared his throat and took a gulp of water. Then he read it again, more slowly, and his expression changed. He said that the woman and the men were old and close friends of Mrs. Malloy and would do anything for her. That if she had left the theater for part of the time, they wouldn't hesitate to lie for her and say she hadn't. That there was no point in his spilling his guts, his phrase, unless it cleared him of the murder charge, and it probably wouldn't. And even if it did, then she would certainly be suspected and her alibi would be checked. And if it proved to be false, she would be where he was then. I couldn't very well impeach his logic.
No, Wolf agreed.
But I was convinced of his innocence. His almost hysterical relief on learning of her alibi, then the doubt creeping in, then his changing expression as he read the paper again and grasped the possibilities. If that was all counterfeit, I should be disbarred for incompetence.
Certainly I'm not competent to judge, Wolf stated, since I didn't see him. But since I have my own reason for not thinking it as simple as it seems, I won't challenge yours. What else?
Nothing positive. Only negatives. I had to promise him I wouldn't cross-examine Mrs. Malloy or quit the case, and I didn't want to quit. I had to accept his refusal to take the witness stand. If he had been framed, the key question was the identity of the man who had made the phone call that made him dash to the Malloy apartment. But he said he had spent hours trying to connect the voice with someone he knew and couldn't. The voice had been hoarse and guttural and presumably disguised, and he couldn't even guess. Two other negatives. He knew of no one who bore him enough ill will to frame him for murder, and he knew of no one who might have wanted Malloy out of the way. In fact, he knows very little about Malloy, if he is to be believed, and I think he is. Of course, the ideal suspect would be a man who coveted Mrs. Malloy and schemed to remove both her husband and Peter Hayes at one stroke. But he is sure there is no such man. On these matters and others, I have had no better luck with Mrs. Malloy.
You have talked with her?
3 times. Once briefly, and twice at length.
She wanted me to arrange for her to see Peter, but he refused to permit it. She wouldn't tell me much about her relations with Peter, and there was no point in pressing her. I knew all I needed to know about that. I spent most of my time with her asking about her husband's activities and associates, everything about him. It had become apparent that I couldn't possibly get my client acquitted unless I found a likely candidate to replace him. She told me all she could, in fact, she told me a lot. But there was a drag on her, and it wasn't hard to guess what the drag was. She thought Peter had killed her husband. The poor woman was pathetic. She kept asking me questions about the gun. It was obvious how her mind was working. She was willing to accept it that Peter had acted in a fit of passion, but if it had happened that way, how account for his having the gun with him? I asked her if there was any chance that the gun had been her husband's there in the apartment, and she was sure there wasn't. When I told her that Peter had denied his guilt and that I believed him, and why, she just stared at me. I asked her if she had in fact been continuously with her companions at the theater that evening, and she said yes. But her mind wasn't on that, it was on Peter. I honestly think she was trying to decide whether I really believed him, or was only pretending to. As for what she told me about her husband, I didn't have the funds for a proper investigation. He stopped because Fritz had entered and was standing there. Fritz spoke. "Luncheon is ready, sir." Wolf got up.
"If you'll join us, Mr. Fryer, there'll be enough to go around. Chicken livers and mushrooms in white wine. Rice cakes. Another place, Fritz."
Chapter 6. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, I left the house, bound for 171 East 52nd Street, to keep an appointment, made for me by Fryer, with Mrs. Michael M. Malloy. After lunch, we had returned to the office and taken up where we had left off. Fryer had phoned his office to send us the complete file on the case, and it had arrived and been pored over. I had summoned Saul Panzer, Fred Durkin, Ori Cather, and Johnny Keams to report to the office at 6 o'clock. They were our four main standbys, and they would call for a daily outlay of $160, not counting expenses. If it lasted a month, 30 times 160 equals 4,800, so Wolf's self-esteem might come high if he found he couldn't deliver. Nothing had come of any of the leads suggested by what Mrs. Malloy had told Fryer about her deceased husband, and no wonder, since they had been investigated only by a clerk in Fryer's office and a sawbuck squirt supplied by the Harland-eyed Detective Agency. I will concede that they had dug up some relevant facts. Malloy had had a two-room office in a 20-story hive on 46th Street near Madison Avenue, and it said on the door, "Michael M. Malloy, Real Estate." His staff had consisted of a secretary and an errand boy. His rent had been paid for January, which was commendable, since January 1st had been a holiday, and he had died on the 3rd. If he had left a will, it had not turned up. He had been a fight fan and an ice hockey fan. During the last 6 months of his life, he had taken his current secretary, whose name was Delia Brandt, to dinner at a restaurant two or three times a week. But the clerk and the squirt hadn't got any deeper into that. Mrs. Malloy hadn't been very helpful about his business affairs. She said that during her tenure as his secretary, he had apparently transacted most of his business outside the office, and she had never known much about it. He had opened his own mail, which hadn't been heavy, and she had written only 10 or 12 letters a week for him, and less than half of them had been on business matters. Her chief function had been to answer the phone and take messages when he was absent, and he had been absent most of the time. Apparently, he had been interested almost exclusively in rural properties. As far as she knew, he had never had a hand in any New York City real estate transactions. She had no idea what his income was or his assets. As for people who might have had a motive for killing him, she had supplied the name of four men with whom he had been on bad terms, and they had been looked into, but none of them seemed very promising. One of them had merely got sore because Malloy had refused to pay on a bet the terms of which had been disputed, and the others weren't much better. It had to be a guy who had not only croaked Malloy, but had also gone to a lot of trouble to see that someone else got hooked for it, specifically Peter Hayes. And that called for a real character. In the taxi on my way uptown, if someone had hopped in and offered me 10-1 that we had grabbed the short end of the stick, I would have passed. I will ride my luck on occasion, but I like to pick the occasion. Number 171 East 52nd Street was an old walk-up which had had a thorough job of upgrading inside and out, along with the houses on either side. They had all been painted an elegant gray, one with yellow trim, one with blue, and one with green. In the vestibule, I pushed the button at the top of the row, marked Malloy, took the receiver from the hook and put it to my ear, and in a moment was asked who it was. I gave my name, and when the latch clicked, pushed the door open, entered, and took the do-it-yourself elevator to the fifth floor. Emerging, I took a look around, noting where the stairs were. After all, this was the scene of the crime, and I was a detective. Hearing my name called, I turned. She was standing in the doorway. She was only 8 steps away, and by the time I reached her, I had made a decision which sometimes, with one female or another, may take me hours or even days. I wanted no part of her. The reason I wanted no part was that just one look had made it plain that if I permitted myself to want a part, it would be extremely difficult to keep from going on and wanting the whole. And that was highly inadvisable in the circumstances. For one thing, it wouldn't have been fair to P.H., handicapped as he was. This would have to be strictly business, not only outwardly but inwardly. I admit I smiled at her as she moved aside to let me enter, but it was merely a professional smile. The room she led me into, after I put my coat and hat on a chair in the foyer, was a large and attractive living room with 3 windows. It was the room that P.H. had entered to find a corpse, if you're on our side. The rugs and furniture had been selected by her. Don't ask me how I know that. I was there and saw them and saw her with them. She went to a chair over near a window and, invited, I moved one around to face her. She said that Mr. Fryer had told her on the phone that he was consulting with Nero Wolfe, and that Mr. Wolfe wanted to send his assistant, Mr. Goodwin, to have a talk with her. And that was all she knew. She did not add, "What do you want?" "I don't know exactly how to begin," I told her, "because we have different opinions on a very important point. Mr. Fryer and Mr. Wolfe and I all think Peter Hayes didn't kill your husband, and you think he did." She jerked her chin up. "Why do you say that?" "Because there's no use beating around the bush. You think it because there's nothing else for you to think, and anyhow you're not really thinking. You've been hit so hard that you're too numb to think. We're not. Our minds are free and we're trying to use them. But we'd like to be sure on one point. If we prove we're right, if we get him cleared, I don't say it looks very hopeful, but if we do, would you like that or wouldn't you?" "Oh," she cried. Her jaw loosened. She said, "Oh," again, but it was only a whisper. "I'll call that a yes," I said. "Then just forget our difference of opinion, because opinions don't count anyway. Mr. Fryer spent 5 hours with Nero Wolfe today, and Mr. Wolfe is going to try to find evidence that will clear Peter Hayes. He has seen reports of your conversations with Fryer, but they didn't help any. Since you were Malloy's secretary for 1 year, and his wife for 3 years, Mr. Wolfe thinks it likely, or say possible, that at some time you saw or heard something that would help. Remember, he is assuming that someone else killed Malloy. He thinks it's very probable that a situation existed which resulted in Malloy's murder, and that he never said or did anything in your presence that had a bearing on it.
She shook her head, not at me, but at Fate.
If he did, she said, I didn't know it.
Of course you didn't. If you had, you would have told Fryer. Mr. Wolfe wants to try to dig it up. He couldn't ask you to come to his office so he could start the digging himself, because he has to spend 2 hours every afternoon playing with orchids, and at 6 o'clock he has a conference scheduled with 4 of his men who are going to be given other assignments on this case. So he sent me to start in with you. I'll tell you how it works by giving you an example. Once I saw him spend 8 hours questioning a young woman about everything and nothing. She wasn't suspected of anything. He was merely hoping to get some little fact that would give him a start. At the end of 8 hours, he got it. She had once seen a newspaper with a piece cut out of the front page. With that fact for a start, he got proof that a man had committed a murder. That's how it works. We'll start at the beginning, when you were Malloy's secretary, and I'll ask questions. We'll keep at it as long as you can stand it.
It seems... Her hand fluttered.
I caught myself noticing how nice her hands were, and had to remind myself that that had all been decided. She said,
It seems so empty. I mean, I'm empty.
You're not really empty, you're full. When and where did you first meet Malloy?
That was 4 years ago, she said. The way you... what you want to try... wouldn't it be better to start later? If there was a situation the way you say, it would have been more recent, wouldn't it?
You never know, Mrs. Malloy. It seemed stiff to be calling her Mrs. Malloy. She fully deserved to be called Selma. Anyhow, I have my instructions from Mr. Wolfe. And by the way, I skipped something. I was to tell you how simple it could have been. Say I decided to kill Malloy and frame Peter Hayes for it. The drugstore on the corner is perfectly placed for me.
Having learned that you are out for the evening and Malloy is alone in the apartment, at 9 o'clock I phone Peter Hayes from the booth in the drugstore and tell him, Fryer has told you what Peter says I told him. Then I cross the street to his house, am admitted by Malloy, shoot him, leave the gun here on a chair, knowing it can't be traced, go back down to the street, watch the entrance from a nearby spot until I see Hayes arrive in a taxi and enter the building, return to the drugstore, and phone the police that a shot has just been fired on the top floor of 171 East 52nd Street. You couldn't ask for anything simpler than that.
She was squinting at me, concentrating. It gave the corners of her eyes a little upturn.
I see, she said. Then you're not just...
She stopped. Just playing games? No. We really mean it. Settle back and relax a little. When and where did you first meet Malloy? She interlaced her fingers. No relaxing.
I wanted another job. I was modeling and didn't like it, and I knew shorthand. An agency sent me to his office, and he hired me.
Had you ever heard of him before?
No.
What did he pay you?
I started at 60, and in about 2 months he raised it to 70.
When did he begin to show a personal interest in you?
Why, almost right away. The second week he asked me to have dinner with him. I didn't accept, and I liked the way he took it. He knew how to be nice when he wanted to. He always was nice to me until after we were married.
Exactly what were your duties? I know what you told Fryer, but we're going to fill in.
There weren't many duties, really. I mean, there wasn't much work. I opened the office in the morning. Usually he didn't come in until around 11 o'clock. I wrote his letters, but that didn't amount to much.
and answered the phone and did the filing, what there was of it. He opened the mail himself.
Did you keep his books?
I don't think he had any books. I never saw any.
Did you draw his checks?
I didn't at first, but later he asked me to sometimes.
Where did he keep his checkbook?
In a drawer of his desk that he kept locked. There wasn't any safe in the office.
Did you do any personal chores for him, like getting prize fight tickets or buying neckties?
No, or very seldom. He did things like that himself.
Hadn't he ever been married before?
No, he said he hadn't.
Did you go to prize fights with him?
Sometimes I did, not often. I didn't like them. And later, the last 2 years, we didn't go places together much.
Let's stick to the first year while you were working for him. Were there many callers at the office?
Not many, no. Many days there weren't any.
How many in an average week, would you say?
Perhaps, she thought. I don't know, perhaps 8 or 9. Maybe 12.
Take the first week you were there. You were new then and noticing things. How many callers were there the first week, and who were they? She opened her eyes at me. Wide open, they were quite different from when they were squinting. I merely noted that fact professionally.
But, Mr. Goodwin, she said, that's impossible. It was 4 years ago.
I nodded. That's just a warm-up. Before we're through, you'll be remembering lots of things you would have thought impossible, and most of them will be irrelevant and immaterial. I hope not all of them. Try it. Callers the first week. We kept at it for nearly 2 hours, and she did her best. She enjoyed none of it, and some of it was really painful. When we were on the latter part of the year, the period when she was cottoning to Malloy, or thought she was, and was making up her mind to marry him. She would have preferred to let the incidents of that period stay where they were, down in the cellar. I won't say it hurt me as much as it did her, since with me it was strictly business, but it was no picnic. Finally, she said she didn't think she could go on, and I said we had barely started.
"Then tomorrow?" she asked. "I don't know why, but this seems to be tougher than it was with the police and the district attorney. That seems strange, since they were enemies and you're a friend." "You are a friend, aren't you?"
It was a trap, and I dodged it. "I want what you want," I told her.
"I know you do, but I just can't go on. Tomorrow?"
"Sure, tomorrow morning. But I'll have some other errands, so it will have to be with Mr. Wolfe. Could you be at his office at 11 o'clock?
"I suppose I could, but I'd rather go on with you."
"He's not so bad. If he growls, just ignore it. He'll dig up something quicker than I would in order to get rid of you. He doesn't appreciate women, and I do." I got out a card and handed it to her. "There's the address, tomorrow at 11. She said yes and got up to see me to the door, but I told her that with a friend it wasn't necessary. Chapter 7. When I got back to 35th Street, it was 6:30, and the conference was in full swing. I was pleased to see that Saul Panzer was in the red leather chair. Unquestionably, Johnny Keams had made a go for it, and Wolf himself must have shooed him off. Johnny, who at one time, under delusions of grandeur, had decided my job would look better on him, or he would look better on it, no matter which, but had found it necessary to abandon the idea, was a pretty good operative, but had to be handled. Fred Durkin, big and burly and bald, knows exactly what he can expect of his brains and what he can't, which is more than you can say for a lot of people with a bigger supply. Ori Cather is smart, both in action and in appearance. As for Saul Panzer, I thoroughly approve of his preference for freelancing, since if he decided he wanted my job, he would get it, or anybody else's.
Saul, as I say, was in the red leather chair, and the others had three of the yellow ones in a row facing Wolf's desk. I got greetings and returned them and circled around to my place. Wolf remarked that he hadn't expected me so early. "I tired her out," I told him. "Her heart was willing, but her mind was weak. She'll be here at 11 in the morning. Do you want it now?"
"If you got anything promising."
I don't know whether I did or not. We were at it nearly 2 hours, and mostly it was just stirring up the dust, but there were a couple of things, maybe three, that you might want to hear. One day in the fall of 1952, she thinks it was October, a man called at the office, and there was a row that developed into combat. She heard a crash and went in, and the caller was flat on the floor. Malloy told her he would handle it, and she returned to the other room, and pretty soon the caller came out on his feet and left. She doesn't know his name, and she didn't hear what the row was about because the door between the rooms was shut.
Wolf grunted. "I hope we are not reduced to that."
"And?" "This one was earlier, in the early summer. For a period of about 2 weeks, a woman phoned the office nearly every day. If Malloy was out, she left word for him to call Janet. If Malloy was in and took the call, he told her he couldn't discuss the matter on the phone and rang off. Then the calls stopped, and Janet was never heard from again."
"Does Mrs. Malloy know what she wanted to discuss?"
"No, she never listened in. She wouldn't." He sent me a sharp glance.
"Are you bewitched again?"
"Yes, sir. It took 4 seconds, even before she spoke. From now on, you'll pay me, but I'll really be working for her. I want her to be happy. When that's attended to, I'll go off to some island and mope." Ori Cather laughed, and Johnny Keams tittered. I ignored them and went on. The third thing was in February or March 1953, not long before they were married. Malloy phoned around noon and said he had expected to come to the office but couldn't make it. His ticket for a hockey game that night was in a drawer of his desk, and he asked her to get it and send it to him by messenger at a downtown restaurant. He said it was in a small blue envelope in the drawer. She went to the drawer and found the envelope and noticed that it had been through the mail and slit open. Inside there were two things, the hockey ticket and a blue slip of paper, which she glanced at. It was a bill from the Metropolitan Safe Deposit Company for rent of a safe deposit box made out to Richard Randall. It caught her eye because she had once thought she might marry a man named Randall, but had decided not to. She put it back in the envelope, which was addressed to Richard Randall, but if she noticed the address, she has forgotten it. She had forgotten the whole incident until we dug it up.
"At least," Wolf said, "if it's worth a question, we know where to ask it. Anything else?"
"I don't think so, unless you want the works."
"Not now."
He turned to the others.
"Now that you've heard Archie, you gentlemen are up to date. Have you any more questions?"
Johnny Keams cleared his throat. "One thing, I don't get the idea of Hayes being innocent. I only know what I read in the papers, but it certainly didn't take the jury very long."
"You'll have to take that from me." Wolf was brusque.
You have to be brusque with Johnny. He turned to me.
"I've explained the situation to them in some detail, but I have not mentioned our client's name or the nature of his interest. We'll keep that to ourselves. Any more questions?"
There were none.
"Then we'll proceed to assignments. Archie, what about phone booths in the neighborhood?"
The drugstore that Fryer mentioned is the nearest place with a booth. I didn't look around much. He went to Durkin.
"Fred, you will try that."
The phone call to Peter Hayes at 9 o'clock was probably made from nearby, and the one to the police at 9:18 had to be made as quickly as possible after Peter Hayes was seen entering the building. The hope is, of course, forlorn, since more than 3 months have passed, but you can try it. The drugstore seems the likeliest, but cover the neighborhood.
If both phone calls were made from the same place, it's possible you can jog someone's memory. Start this evening at once. The calls were made in the evening. Any questions?
No, sir. I've got it.
Fred never takes his eyes off of Wolf. I think he's expecting him to sprout either a horn or a halo, I'm not sure which, and doesn't want to miss it.
Shall I go now?
No, you might as well stay till we're through. Wolf went to Cather. Ori, you will look into Malloy's business operations and associates and his financial standing. Mr. Fryer will see you at his office at 10 in the morning. He'll give you whatever information he has, and you will start with that. Getting access to Malloy's records and papers will be rather complicated.
If he kept books, I said, they weren't in his office. At least Mrs. Malloy never saw them, and there was no safe.
Indeed. Wolf's brows went up. A real estate brokerage business and no books? I think, Archie, I'd better have a full report on the dust you stirred up. He returned to Ori. Since Malloy died intestate, as far as is known, his widow's rights are paramount in such matters as access to his records and papers, but they should be exercised as legal procedure provides. Mr. Fryer says that Mrs. Malloy has no attorney, and I'm going to suggest to her that she retain Mr. Parker. Mr. Fryer thinks it inadvisable to suggest him, and I agree. If Malloy kept no records in his office, you will first have to find them. Any questions?
Ori shook his head.
Not now. I may have after I've talked with Fryer. If I do, I'll phone you.
Wolf made a face.
Except in emergencies, the boys never call between 9 and 11 in the morning or 4 and 6 in the afternoon, when he is up in the plant rooms. But even so, the damn phone rings when he's deep in a book or working a crossword or busy in the kitchen with Fritz, and he hates it. He went to Keem's.
Johnny, Archie will give you names and addresses. Mrs. Thomas L. Irwin and Mr. and Mrs. Jerome Arkoff. They were Mrs. Malloy's companions at the theater. It was Mrs. Arkoff who phoned Mrs. Malloy that she had an extra ticket and invited her to join them. That may have no significance. X may merely have been awaiting an opportunity and grasped it. But he must have known that Mrs. Malloy would be out for the evening, and it is worth inquiry. Two investigators looked into it for Mr. Fryer, but they were extraordinarily clumsy, judging by their reports. If you get any hint that the invitation to Mrs. Malloy was designed, confer with me at once. I have known you to overstrain your talents.
When? Johnny demanded.
Wolf shook his head.
Some other time. Will you communicate with me if you find cause for suspicion?
Sure, if you say so.
I do say so.
Wolf turned to Saul Panzer.
For you, Saul, I had something in mind, but it can wait. It may be worth the trouble to learn why Malloy had in his possession an envelope addressed to Richard Randall, containing a bill for rental of a safe deposit box, even though it was more than 3 years ago. If it were a simple matter to get information from the staff of a safe deposit company about a customer, I wouldn't waste you on it, but I know it isn't.
Any questions?
Maybe a suggestion, Saul offered. Archie might phone Lon Cohen at the Gazette and ask him to give me a good print of a picture of Malloy. That would be better than a newspaper reproduction.
The other three exchanged glances.
They were all good operatives, and it would have been interesting to know, as a check on their talents, whether they had all caught the possibility as quickly as Saul had that Malloy had himself been Richard Randall. There was no point in asking them, since they would all have said yes.
That will be done, Wolf told him. Anything else?
No, sir.
Wolf came to me.
Archie, you've gone through Mr. Fryer's file and seen the report on Miss Delia Brandt, Malloy's secretary, at the time of his death. You know where to find her?
Right.
Please do so. If she has anything we can use, get it.
Since you are working for Mrs. Malloy, you may need her approval. If so, get that.
Saul smiled. Ori laughed. Johnny tittered. Fred grinned.